This series includes references to sexual assault, violence, and outdated source language regarding mental health. Listener discretion is advised. This is part one in a two-part series. This is The Fall Line. Friday, June 7th, 1985, Nashville, Tennessee. It was gearing up to be a hot summer, with the temperature creeping toward the 90s at the height of the afternoon. But it had been a strange week, with softball-sized hail slamming down in some areas of Davidson County outside Metro Nashville. Cicadas crawled up from the earth to make their presence known, too. 13 years could go by fast. A 24-year-old man named Ricky Lee Franks had just gotten back to Nashville. As far as we know, he arrived that day, June 7th, the same day he disappeared. But that's the problem with a case dating back nearly 40 years. Records aren't digitized. And Ricky told his family that he'd been put on a bus from the group home he'd been living in over in Dixon. Ricky was described in police reports as diagnosed with a non-specified intellectual disability and also experiencing occasional emotional or violent outbursts. His oldest sister, Sylvia, will explain that situation in more detail later in the episode. She was closest to Ricky of the family and worried about him all the time. Sylvia had been splitting her time between California and Nashville in the mid-1980s. And happened to be back in Tennessee for a few months in 1985. She was there when he disappeared and made sure he was reported missing. She's the person who has pursued his case, first from the West Coast and then locally, after she relocated back to Nashville in 2000 or so. It's still hard for Sylvia to talk about her brother. She feels that he was dealt a lot of hurt in life. She hopes that she'll get a call with news that he's been found alive, living somewhere in another state. But she dreads it will be another kind of notification. At the same time, not knowing, it feels just as bad. How Ricky Franks came to be in Nashville that day, June 7th, that's actually a little cloudy. For now, we'll begin with the original story. According to Metro Nashville police records, a social worker at the group home told police that Ricky had been sent home because of, quote, disciplinary problems. What that meant from a practical standpoint was that he was back in town with no resources. No money, no vehicle, and this was long before cell phones. Ricky's options were limited. We know he ultimately decided to head back to his old neighborhood in the Inglewood area. That's where his mother, his stepfather, and some of his siblings, his half-siblings, still lived. His mother would see him that day, at least briefly. So would his youngest half-sister, who was in the car with his mother when they encountered Ricky walking down Shelton Avenue. They went off to pick him up some food while Ricky waited back in the neighborhood. At that point, it seems that Ricky decided to walk to his old home and wait there at least for a while. His half-brother, who was sometimes referred to as stepbrother in the press, would also report that he heard Ricky come to the door. Ricky's half-brother told their oldest sister that he didn't let him in, and Ricky left. But after that point, what happened to Ricky Franks? No one has been able to trace him, not for certain. He did not return to the group home in Dixon, and though there was a man who might have been Ricky Franks, or a Ricky Franks, who turned up decades later in Georgia, his sister Sylvia doesn't think that mysterious lead has anything to do with her brother. There was little mention of Ricky in the 1980s news cycle, at least what we can access. He may have appeared on televised broadcasts, but his missing persons report, filed 4 days after he disappeared, and the files detectives built year after year, provides information that, combined with Sylvia's memories, presents several theories in the case. someone who knew Ricky might have done something to him. Ricky had been hurt by people in the neighborhood before. Perhaps it had happened again. Ricky had been known to take rides with friendly strangers, so that could have occurred as well. Ricky could have gone in search of some of his friends. He had some, from church, that he'd known before leaving for the group home. Ricky's last boyfriend, he'd moved out of state to Texas. Was it possible that Ricky would try to reach him? Ricky might have been involved in an accident, but, of course, no fatalities were reported involving someone who looked like Ricky in Nashville that week. That doesn't mean there wasn't an accident. It could have been something that police didn't know about. Ricky's missing persons case has been in the hands of a number of investigators over the years. The advent of a dedicated cold case unit is comparatively recent. Now, Detective Matthew Filter has charge of his file and some of the other older cases in Metro Nashville. He hopes that the Nashville Crime Stoppers offer of a reward for tips in the case, up to $1,000, might stir up leads from a neighborhood that knew Ricky Franks well. Maybe someone saw something that day that could help. Perhaps someone listening to this episode right now lived in the area and knew Ricky and could remember something about that summer of 1985 that might advance the investigation into his disappearance. We found out about Ricky's case after a listener in Nashville saw an article run by a local news station, WKRN, highlighting his case. When we reached out to Metro Nashville's cold case unit, to Detective Filter, he connected us with Ricky's sister Sylvia. And when we spoke to Detective Filter for these episodes, he explained how the Metro Nashville Police Department's cold case handling has transformed over the years, and how he got involved himself in Ricky's case.
I really enjoy the cold cases. I spent 13 years working what we call fresh homicides, and I really enjoyed that. But it's a lot of work, and it takes a lot of time out of your life doing that because of just the on-call rotations, and then things going on when you get assigned as the lead to one, you're really having to work hard because those first 48 to 72 hours are very critical. So you find yourself working and maybe just catching a 2 or 3 hour nap and then getting back at it, and so it over time it really wears you down. And so in fact, with a lot of these cold cases, time is often our friend because people's attitudes towards what happens changes, and we start getting phone calls, relationships change. So, we'll get people calling in tips and wanting to give up information on something that happened, 5-10 years ago. I was a detective in the East Precinct. We used to be under a what we call the decentralized model of investigation, where all the homicides and missing persons, robberies, burglaries, pretty much most investigations were handled by the individual precinct that the crime occurred in. So when I say I was working homicide, I was actually an investigator in the East Precinct working homicide. And this case, these older cases, the missing persons cases anyways, remained in the precincts. The cold homicide cases went to our cold case unit, which was a centralized unit, but the missing persons cases remained within the individual precincts. And I don't know exactly what sparked someone looking into it again, but there was a detective that I worked with. His name was Detective Gary Clements, and he had picked up this case, I want to say it was in 2006 or 2007, and started working it. And I got involved with him, just helping him with some stuff. And we went and interviewed Ricky's sister, Sylvia, and I helped him with some other research on it. But that was the very first time I ever saw Ricky Frank's case. And then it just kind of disappeared. They decided that they were going to re-centralize all the missing persons cases because they felt that they could be kept track of and work more efficiently if they went to a centralized unit. So all the missing person cases, including the new ones, all got assigned to the cold case unit, and it's still that way today. And I came to the cold case unit about 6 years ago, and it, probably after I was here for a couple years, I got curious about a couple missing persons cases that I had worked or helped with when I was at the East Precinct. I just pulled them up, and Ricky Franks was one of them I started looking at. And I just kind of started reviewing through it, and I thought, you know, it looks like there's some things that maybe could be done. I mean, it doesn't look like anything overly promising, but, you know, there's definitely a few things that, you know, people can probably be re-interviewed and some other information dug into just to see if any new leads could come up in the case.
Ricky's case file grew significantly after that point. And without access to it, we wouldn't be able to cover Ricky's case at all. There is so little available on Ricky Lee Franks that we'd only be able to tell you that his family lived on Norval Avenue at the time of his disappearance, and that he'd been in a group home, and that the last time he was seen, he was described as a white male with blonde hair and blue eyes, and that he was around 5'10" and 145 pounds. If you check NamUs, there are a long list of unidentified person rule-outs tied to Ricky's case. His sister's and mother's DNA is on file with the county, but we wouldn't know that much even without the interviews and the case file. Ricky Lee Frank's life in Nashville and in Dixon had to be pieced together from what Sylvia remembers and from the records the police have searched out and the interviews that they've done. There are some things that we just can't know for sure, like what exactly happened at the group home. How precisely did Ricky Franks get on that Greyhound bus? There isn't a manifest to prove that he rode in on a particular bus that day. Where did he go after he left his family's home on Norval Avenue, and what happened to him? Sylvia, Ricky's older sister, talked to us about their childhood and what led up to Ricky's relocation to the group home over in Dixon.
I was born in Nashville. My mom was married to my dad, and then they split up. I was about five. She married my stepfather, and he raised us. It was me and my sister Janice and Ricky. Then my mother had three other children by my stepfather. When I think back to our childhood, which I do often, he was never really wanted by my stepfather. I don't know why he had such an aversion to Ricky's existence. Ricky was a sweet, beautiful little boy. And he just didn't want him around. And my father, I call him my father because he raised us. But as far as his children, he never really treated us differently. But Ricky was always the black sheep. He was not wanted around. And he was really ignored. And I always tried to give him attention, being the oldest child. Back then, it wasn't like it is now where children are really engaged in the family. The kids are sort of, like when I think back to it, we were just sort of there. There wasn't interpersonal conversations or anything like that. We were just there. And I was asthmatic, so I was sick a lot. And so I had to go to the ER a lot. And I can remember my dad getting mad about that because mama would have to give me, you know, extra attention. And then when I was 11, Daddy bought us a house, the house that Ricky was last seen at. And he bought this house, and it was six children and Mama and Daddy. You know, it wasn't a horrible childhood. I think compared to a lot of people, it might have been. But for us, we didn't really know any better. Daddy would run us out of the house. Like, if he got angry, there were times we literally were in our nightgowns out in the yard, you know. But then he would get over it, and we'd go back in. Because my dad's gone, I have forgiven him. But Daddy could also be very funny. There was one salary and six children. And he would take us, you know, to the Crystal. Back then, it was a drive-in. And we'd get crystals and ride through the park. And, you know, I think he did the best he could. Really, considering his upbringing.
In Sylvia's recollection, one issue that her half-brother and stepfather had with Ricky was that he was gay, though it was not openly discussed in the home. And the family also struggled with the best way to help Ricky in an era when mental health care was much less advanced.
His anger, you know, because he would get so frustrated. And now, looking back, I understand it all so well, the way he was treated. He was in and out of mental institutes and institutions, and he had a psychiatrist, because when he started school is when we knew something was wrong. He had some speech impediments and learning disabilities. And so had he been diagnosed today, a lot of it probably would have been anxiety. But they said he was paranoid schizophrenic. And if he was provoked, he could be abusive. I mean, like one time he got mad at me. And like I said, he was my baby in my heart. And he kicked me, and he busted out my windshield in my car. He had a relationship with this guy, and truthfully, we were relieved because, okay, he's got somebody that cares about him. Maybe this will work out, and he'll have some kind of normal life. Because him and the guy moved in together in some little apartment, and we helped him furnish it, but he ended up moving to Dallas.
Can I ask you initially, when was the first time you remember your parents bringing up the idea that he might be moving into a group home?
Well, it was never like they had a meeting. They never live like that. But they told, when Ricky was a teenager, because we tried everything. I had a roommate, and I was young at the time, because there was just 4 years difference between me and Ricky. But I had a roommate, and Mom and Daddy kicked him out of the house. And so she said, well, we'll go get him. He can stay with us. Okay. So we had a duplex, and I worked two jobs at the time. And I had called Ricky. Cindy, my roommate, had, she wasn't there, or she had moved out or whatever the situation. But so I called him from my second job, and I said, I'm on my way home. Do you want something from McDonald's? And he said, yes. And I said, okay. And when I got home, Brooke, the front door had been knocked in because Ricky had called a bomb threat in to Vanderbilt, and they had arrested him. So the cops said it was a cry for help. See, when I spoke with him, he was okay, but I think he got anxious waiting on me, and he got lonely because he was there by himself. And I really thought I could take care of him. And so they took him, and he was in jail.
We don't have much information about the bomb threat that Sylvia mentioned. Her explanation, that Ricky had connections to Vanderbilt and was feeling highly stressed because he'd been alone all day in a new environment, that was the best answer that Sylvia had. Her foremost concern at the time was what Ricky shared with her after he was released from jail. When Ricky's family was able to get him out, he told Sylvia that while he was in custody, he'd been sexually assaulted. Ricky had also been assaulted as a preteen in their own neighborhood, allegedly by a teenage neighbor. We were told that this person allegedly assaulted other children in the neighborhood as well, and we do have news and police records that prove that he, along with several other men, went on to be convicted of the robbery of a local convenience store and the kidnapping and sexual assault of the clerk who was working at the time. But our understanding is that the assaults against Ricky were not reported to the police at the time that they occurred.
He went to live with my uncle, and that didn't work out. I can't remember the specifics of it, but somehow it didn't work out. And so they said he needs to be in a controlled environment. His psychiatrist, which I don't even know what happened to him. But so we had him in Central State, which is it's no longer here. But he was so drugged up. When I would go get him on Sundays, he would just be like a zombie. So then I'm trying to see how it, I think with all of us trying to, we tried to get him an apartment, a little duplex near my mom. And so we put him in there and we said, you know, we'll check on you and make sure you're okay, and which we did. But then he would just disappear for a few days. So the landlord said, you know, this isn't going to work. I wish I had the exact dates, but Mama said, you know, we're just going to have to put him in a group home. And I thought, well, we can try. I didn't like it because the group home was in Dixon, Tennessee, which it's about 45 minutes to an hour from Nashville. And Ricky was terrified there. It was a big old home full of, you know, people with mental issues. But Ricky would call me and he would say, they said they were going to cut me up, cut my legs off. And of course, hearing this, you know, was horrible. And he, I don't know if it was the medication or in fact this really happened, because when I went to visit him at the group home, I just got the creeps. I did feel like everything that Ricky had said was probably true, because he would, the guy that ran it, him and his wife, it was such a creepy environment. And I was very upset with Mama and my siblings. And so this is not safe for Ricky, you know. And so we didn't know what to do at that point. And Mama said, well, we'll figure out what to do.
Detective Filter explained what he was able to gather about Ricky's stay at the center in Dixon, both from further family interviews and investigation.
From what I've been told, is it was very questionable whether Ricky should have even been in that home, whether, you know, what his his disability was really warranted him being in that home. So I really don't know why his mother decided to put him there, but she did. And he was in that home for at least a couple years. And I think there were a lot of problems in that home. His sister described some times where he had actually received threats from other residents in the home. I think he was generally unhappy being there. And I even contacted the Dixon County Sheriff's Department because that home actually fell within their jurisdiction back in the 1980s. And unfortunately, they didn't have any records from back then to really be able to say who was living there or any specific reports. But the detective from the sheriff's department that I spoke to, he was a patrol deputy back then, and he actually remembered this house and even told me he remembered going to this house on a regular basis to handle different types of calls, disorderly residents, fights, etc. So it was known to be a problem spot for law enforcement back then. He was taking some type of medication. His sister had told me that when he was on his medication, he was okay. But she always had concerns when he got off his medication for too long that he could become aggressive.
What Sylvia could do was limited. She was in California and had to keep in touch mostly by phone. She moved back to Nashville, though, for a few months in 1985. She was actually in town when Ricky disappeared, but Sylvia wouldn't find out about him going missing for several days. It was when he failed to make contact with her from the center in Dixon that she began to worry, and she reached out to her family.
I said, Ricky hasn't called me. And she said, oh, he's just ran off again. She said, we saw him. I said, what do you mean you saw him? I said, he's in the group home. And she said, no, they put him on a Greyhound bus and sent him here. And my mother was taking my baby sister somewhere, and she saw Ricky going down the street. And she stopped, and she said, what are you doing? He said, they put me on the bus.
According to Sylvia, no one from the center had called to alert her family that Ricky would be traveling to Nashville. Her mother and sister said that Ricky was acting oddly that day, that he seemed dazed and a little out of sorts when they stopped and spoke to him on Shelton Avenue, which was near their home on Norville.
They said it was like he wasn't there. I said, okay, what do you mean? Well, he just didn't seem there. I said, well, he was probably on so many medications. See, they would drug him up so much that they were like zombies. I said, well, do you remember what he had on? And she told me he just acted weird. She was just a kid, you know, a teenager. But my mom didn't let him in the car because if he was provoked, she was scared to let him in the car. So she told him to go to the house and she would bring some food. And that's how she went back and he wasn't there. But they said he just acted like he wasn't there.
For a long time, Sylvia only knew the first part of this story, that her mother and sister saw Ricky, and her mother went out to buy him some food, and that her mother decided not to let him into the car. It was only after her stepfather's funeral that she found out that Ricky had actually gone to their family home, and that Sylvia's half-brother had seen Ricky there.
I made the comment, I said, I can't believe Daddy's out there in a grave tonight. And I don't know where my brother's body is. And he goes, oh, you know, he came by here that day. And I never had heard about this book. I said, what? He goes, yeah, he came by here and he knocked on the door and I didn't let him in. I said, well, what? Where did he go? He goes, he just walked down Norville.
When Sylvia found out that Ricky'd been seen, been to their family home, and then disappeared and not contacted anyone for days, she called the group home in Dixon and spoke to its owner. She was given a completely different story than the one Ricky had told her mother and youngest sister when he'd seen them on Shelton Avenue.
I said, but, you know, how did this happen? He said, well, I sent him to, I dropped him off at the mission. I said, no, he told my mom he was on a Greyhound bus. Well, at that time, there was no manifest to prove that he was ever on a Greyhound bus. He said, well, he's at the mission. So I went down to the mission and I talked to the guy that runs the mission. I said, where's Ricky's stuff? There's no stuff here. Do you have to sign in? Where's his signature? He said, I said, how do you know he was here? He said, I don't remember him being here.
The mission shelter had no record. So Sylvia, again, tried to get more answers out of the management at the group home and even spoke to their family's attorney.
They said, well, we tried to get a hold of people, but the phones were out. That's not true. And they said the day before Ricky disappeared, I guess he had a big outburst. And I don't see Ricky being able to get on a bus in this horrible rural area of Dixon that he was living in at the group home.
Now, Sylvia suspects that the owner of the home may have actually dropped Ricky off in Nashville, maybe at the mission shelter, maybe not, but she doesn't have any real idea. And that still wouldn't explain where the Greyhound story came from. Someone could have purchased him a ticket and heavily medicated him for the trip. That would explain why he was, as his mother and youngest sister described, so dazed and out of it when they saw him. When Detective Filter took over Ricky's case, he looked more closely at how exactly Ricky got to Nashville that day, and what he ended up with was another confusing new story.
Ricky basically said that the people at the group home put him on a bus and sent him to Nashville due to, I guess, disciplinary problems. When I contacted the man that ran the group home back then, he said that Ricky was the one that actually wanted to leave. He said that he never had any problems with Ricky. He said that there weren't any issues at the group home, that everybody got along great, and that he really hated to see Ricky go. But one of the things that he says is he's denied ever putting Ricky on a bus. He claims that Ricky's mother had picked up Ricky about 2 weeks prior to him disappearing and just never brought him back. So, you know, we've got kind of this oddball story of, you know, Ricky's seen walking down the street or shows up at mom's house and tells mom and his baby stepsister that, you know, that he was put on a bus in Nashville. And here the guy that's running the group home denies that he was ever put on a bus, that he just left, and that it was actually his mother that picked him up and took him away.
So there was no clear trail to follow when Sylvia discovered Ricky'd been seen in Nashville on June 7th, 1985, a Friday. Several days had already passed. She checked the mission, the group home, nothing. Sylvia's mother was still convinced that Ricky would turn back up. She pointed out that he'd disappeared for a few days before, but that had been when he had a home and was living in town.
I said, Mama, he's not coming back. Because he always called me. And just something, you know, when people are missing, they don't call, it's because they can't call. Especially Ricky, because he always called. I said, okay, we have to file a missing persons report. Oh, no, he'll be back. I said, no, I'll do it then.
Next time on The Fall Line, the disappearance of Ricky Lee Franks becomes an official investigation, and a lead takes detectives across state lines. If you lived in the Norval Avenue or Shelton Avenue area, which we're told is also known as the neighborhood of Inglewood, in 1985, and have any memory of seeing Ricky Franks that summer, please reach out to Metro Nashville Police Department. At the time of his disappearance, Ricky Lee Franks was described as a white male of medium build, about 5'10" and 145 pounds, with straight, medium-length blonde hair and blue eyes. He was last seen wearing blue jeans and a blue shirt. You can see a picture of Ricky on the Fall Line social media. You can contact Detective Filter at 615-862-7803. You can also call Nashville Crime Stoppers at 615-74-CRIME or 615-742-7463. You can remain anonymous and qualify for a cash reward. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Now, briefly, we want to share information regarding an event that Donna Green, mother of Raymond Green, will be hosting in November in Atlanta. Donna runs the nonprofit, the Raymond Green International Outreach of Hope, and holds a fundraising gala each November in Raymond's honor. He was kidnapped in November of 1978, just a few days after he was born at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. If you would like to support Donna's mission and attend her gala, please see the link in our show notes where you can learn more about the event. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising funds to continue to pay for the Millbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs for only $5 a month. We've also added occasional video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. If you prefer Apple Premium, we're beginning that feed as well, so you'll have another option for contributing. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrow. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turney. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.